This is Mae Bressel. This is side two of tape 410, and it's October the 12th, 1979. And we're talking about the siege in San Francisco, the sniper that took the city for 23 or 24 hours last Friday and through Saturday, and then was arrested and then died in the San Francisco jail, was found hung Monday morning. And all of these conspiracies or these violences or terrorism set up particularly just prior to elections. Prior to Ronald Reagan's election, when he ran for governor, Mark Essex was shooting down in New Orleans at the Holiday Inn. The Holiday Inn, again, figures in this story. He left handwriting on the walls, and he was murdered, and there was a suggestion that two people were shooting, but only one was killed. And that was the time Ronald Reagan wanted the federal government and the CIA to begin experiments on mind control of people in the United States based upon those violences. This particular terrorist in San Francisco was described by his mother, similar to Tex Watson and other so-called violent terrorists that appeared later, as a altar boy, a good boy, a Boy Scout, a little leaguer. And then around 16 years old, he got into drugs and was locked up in a mental hospital, and something changed his personality. Now, he had mental breakdown, he acted weird, but the unanswered questions always are, what is their source of money? If he was, from the time he was 16, released from a mental hospital, how did he support himself for the next 6 years? How would this young person get out to California, from Rhode Island to New York to Berkeley, down to Texas, Orange County, and travel around? There's a lot of mobility of these people, and I believe they stay at safe houses and mind jobs are done on them, and there's this tactical support of women and no medical history. It's always, of course, the privacy of the patient is protected, so you never know what they were treated for or what doctors had their hands on them. This Wayne Cullinan got an American Express card under the name of Gary McIntosh, but they don't explain where he got the card. He purchased weapons in San Francisco with it, so did Sarah Jane Moore, and weapons from San Francisco ended up in Jonestown, and weapons in San Francisco have been in many mysterious COINTEL programs. As far as the American Express card goes, where did he get it? Was it mailed to him? Was it stolen? Did he have tactical support that somebody handed to him? Was there really a Gary McIntosh that they were using it? Was there anything else on the credit card besides the weapons that would say where he had been or anything about him, and what did he use it for? They also said, in addition to the American Express card, he had traveler's checks. Well, traveler's checks are a way of cash, and he may have been using one of these aliases that match the American Express card. You have to sign your name, but who puts up the cash for the traveler's checks if you're going into fancy motels and traveling around and going up from Los Angeles to the Bay Area, and you're writing traveler's checks? Somebody put the cash behind it. So then the question is, what employment? If he didn't have tactical support, he had a job, unless he stole something, and they haven't proved that he broke into any banks or did any robberies. September the 25th, he rented a yellow car at the Los Angeles airport, and he arrived up in the Bay Area by the 29th of September, and checked into the Redwood townhouse, but the yellow car was painted blue and the license plates were switched. That's another trick to obtain extra license plates. How do you get those? And under whose name were the license plates? Again, tactical support. He has all these identifications that the government provides. Remember when the men were arrested at Watergate and they had the aliases and the identification of different names? Well, how many people can get these traveler's checks without, there's some means of getting those, your American Express card? Who is that Gary McIntosh? He painted a car blue and was in San Francisco next day. Now, it takes 6 or 10 hours to drive from Los Angeles to Redwood City, but where did he paint it blue? Did he have it in a car shop? Did they paint it blue? Did he paint it in front of an apartment? Did he do it himself? Did someone else do it for him? Was there a quick switch? In other words, what tactical technique was used to take a car out of the L.A. airport yellow, have it blue, and be in the Bay Area 4 days later with other license plates? Now, he checked into the Redwood townhouse, and he could have paid either with his American Express card or his traveler's checks. But on September 29th, he went to the Holiday Inn and stole a Mercedes-Benz. Now, he went up to the building in style in a Mercedes-Benz with his army fatigues, with an orange backpack filled with weapons and a stocking mask he's to put on, and he drives to that state building, the insurance building, and goes up to the 16th floor of the office there, this building, in a Mercedes-Benz. Well, now, the sniping spree was over by Sunday, October the 7th, but who owned the car that he drove in? Did the police report it missing? Was it an out-of-town guest? Because the first report was that he was at this Redwood Motel, the Redwood Townhouse, and that he had a car that came from Las Vegas. And now they say that he stole a car from the Holiday Inn in San Francisco. Was it Vegas? Was Vegas involved in this case like it was in all these other tricky little deals? And where was it parked? Where was a stolen Mercedes-Benz parked? Well, the siege was going on in San Francisco at the parking lot, and that's pretty fancy transportation to get himself up to the 16th floor in such a fancy car. Who is the owner, and how did he take it away from the Holiday Inn? How did he get the keys to the car? And how come the police weren't looking for the car and it was in the city? And where was the car held until the siege took place? Because now he had two vehicles of transportation. And where was this car held, this Mercedes, until this date of the siege? The Oakland police stated that they had arrested Wayne Kullian in October of last year, October the 9th, 1978, and that they had arrested him on suspicion of driving under influence of drugs, of auto theft, of possession of stolen property, and driving without a valid license. Now, if he had a history of mental illness and was under influence of the drugs and they arrested him, where was the arrest charge and why didn't they hold him, and how come there was no court hearing or a warrant out for him, or a warrant and they didn't seek him? And another article said that he hadn't had an arrest since 1974 in Rhode Island, but in 1978, the Oakland police seemed to know who he was and didn't go after him. They released him, which is typical of the Oakland police when we get into the SLA and the role they had in letting those people out loose the 3 weeks that they knew members of the SLA's names and occupations until Patty Hearst was successfully kidnapped. Well, the hostage was still held and he was in the building, the television news said that he had a car stolen from Las Vegas. Well, who in Las Vegas did it belong to, and did it come from the LA airport or Las Vegas, and how did they know then, if he was using an alias, about where the car came from? How did Wayne Cullinan, dressed as a comrade in army fatigue with his backpack and all these weapons, get in the building? The story is that he went to the State Compensation Insurance Fund, and he put a gun to the head of a female janitor. They do have security clearances down there, but no metal detectors. He didn't look weird to anybody. He put a gun, as I say, to the head of the janitor, and then he went down the hall and took another secretary in the building down the hall. Then he went to the office of John Webers, the board vice president, who wasn't in of this insurance office, and took the secretary as a hostage. Now, he took one woman as a hostage that he kept there, the one who later said, did I do okay? Did I do all right? And he released the other two people. The secretary and the janitor got away. Now, if he had a gun to their head, two of them, and went into a building where he was going to, he had a backpack, even if it was concealed weapons, he was looking a little weird right now with a gun and a weapon and a stocking mask over his head up on the 16th floor. Did those two people, the janitor and the other secretary, ever call the police? There's no record that the police knew anything that was going on in this building until he made calls out on the telephone in that office with a perfect view of all of Market Street, and he could tie up 16 blocks and threaten to bomb the city and inconvenience people in that whole area. It's a very strategic area with crosswalks. Across the street is the theater where Danson was playing. That show was canceled. Further down the street was the Opera House. People were at the opera but left early and left their cars at the underground parking and so forth. There was near a law school, Hastings Law School, that had to put off tests that Saturday. People came from Alaska, Florida, and all over, and they couldn't take these law tests because of the sniper. He tied up the entire city, literally, but he had two people who he escorted. They escorted him to where he was going, up on the 16th floor. They had a gun to their head. He had a stocking mask, supposedly. They go downstairs. Don't they yell, "Hey, there's someone upstairs. Go to the 16th floor. The secretary's a hostage up there. We got away." Did they ever report it to the police, or was this synchronized to test, and I'll go into the motives in a little bit, the police psychological systems and the terrorist shtick for these election maneuvers? Because it seems very weird watching and listening to the television and the media, the radio, closely this weekend, that I never saw a face of any of those people who escorted him, and why they never called the police or got into the act of stopping the action immediately, because they could have just run into the 16th floor and taken the room, and even though there was a hostage, just gone in at that time and removed him. There were police nearby the area. It's right near the police department, and it's just a few blocks from Golden Gate, the federal offices and the FBI. Can you visualize him going past security guards in a building with a stocking mask and a bag filled with all kinds of weapons, and just going on upstairs, and those people that escaped from him not responding in any way? The first reports were that Wayne Cullinan, who registered under an alias at this Redwood City Motel, was unknown to anybody, his real name, because he did use his alias. But there was an interview with Mr. Vince Repetto, the officer, the plainclothes officer handling the case. In quotes, he said, "We ran into a problem. We misidentified him for the first 8 hours." That would be Friday and through Friday night. "We thought he was someone else. We got a profile from the Secret Service of a man we thought was our man, but after 8 hours, we realized we didn't have the man." And I'm wondering why the Secret Service was working with Officer Vince Repetto at this time, except that the Secret Service was also working with Sarah Jane Moore and was Squeaky Fromm, and they have a way of getting right into these particular violences that are nestled into the San Francisco, California counterintelligence terrorism. Now, Wayne's girlfriend, much older than him, he was 22, she was 27, she went by the name of Injun. Can you believe this? It reminds me of the stories of the Carter assassination attempt in Los Angeles with that Lee Harvey Oswaldo, those ridiculous names. Her name is Injun Tomlinson, and she had kept Wayne Cullinan with her. She knew him as Chico, and he lived with her for 3 months before he went south. And he came back to her 3 weeks ago and wanted to travel around the country with her. He didn't say how he was going to get his money, but that doesn't matter. Neither did the Manson family, the SLA. They could get to Pennsylvania or Los Angeles. And the transportation, the wheels are there, the false identifications, the extra driver's license, and the license plates. They have that mobility. So Chief Cherokee SLA Wu was friendly with Injun Tomlinson, and she didn't like him because she said she was a hippie. Many of these women up at Telegraph Hill in Berkeley are disguised as hippie. It's really like the Casbah of agents. She was the hippie. He was the straight man. He liked disco. He wasn't political. He was very conservative, straight hair. He didn't like her barefoot, plain clothing. She had him at her place for 3 months. He went south, and then he came back and was ready to take a trip around the country. Except for Injun and one other female friend of hers in Berkeley, who went over to the building while all the negotiations were going on. As I say, there's no man who has seen him, no one who's come forward, no associate, a male, the tactical support coming from the female. And there is just these two women who had any contact with him that the media has bothered to interview. Remember when Artie Brammer was arrested for the attempted killing of George Wallace, and right away his girlfriend comes forward, and they have all these wonderful little females that are used for these human interest stories, but never saying who pays for his hotel at the Waldorf Astoria or a room up in Canada or his transportation to Michigan or the hotel, Marriott Hotel in Maryland. The media never bothers to delve into the really hard questions. They just get the little stories, the Meghan Marshak story with Rockefeller, and never the real story of the males or the manipulation. that makes these activities possible. As I say, in the Manson case, when he got out of prison, he went to Berkeley, to the same area where he went with a librarian who helped set him up, an educated woman, when he got out of prison. And then he went over the Haight-Ashbury area and then began to collect his buses and vans and women. Nancy Ling Perry from Santa Rosa, California, moved down to Berkeley and was active, again, with the government, with intelligence operations, set up the SLA. Another woman working with Donald DeFries, visiting him in prison, and Emily Harris coming out from Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, and the NARC squads there to work in the prison systems with the Black Guerrillas and with Donald DeFries. A Lawrence Kwong, who was an example of terrorism and suicide, self-demolition afterwards in San Francisco, who shot at the KGO building, was with a woman who took him to Hawaii, an older woman, and he was had weapons, an apartment in California Street, a hospitalization with secret reports, again, of what he was doing. That was hushed up. Herbert Mullen, another one of these California zombies, was working, again, at the Holiday Inn, down at the wharf. No, maybe it was a travel lodge he was working at, and I'll have to check that out. Herbert Mullen was taken by a woman, and he was at an army base in Hawaii, and then came home and heard voices and killed a priest and was part of this Santa Cruz, California violence of a mind-control job in the control of a woman. And where did I first learn about women? By the greatest wife of all, Marina Oswald, and the job that she did with Lee Harvey Oswald as the control agent over him in setting up that operation. It's interesting that the Oakland police had an arrest warrant out for Wayne Cullinan, because that's a very important city. The Oakland area is where Candy Jones was sent out all the way from New York City to Dr. Jensen for a mind control job, to be given two personalities so that she could do work for the Central Intelligence Agency. Oakland is the area where Romero and Little were, and the shootouts took place in the Berkeley, Oakland area, in Concord, actually. But there's a small geographical area. One little town runs into the next. And after they were arrested and the house was burned down in Concord, there was the name of Patty Hearst and a getaway van and the information that she'd be kidnapped and the names of Emily William Harris and Willie Wolfe and various members of the SLA. And the Oakland police, the Berkeley police, had 3 weeks to arrest all of these people, and Patty wouldn't have been kidnapped. But they let the violence take place. And, of course, Chief of Police Gaines, that was his territory with the Black Panthers and the various shootouts, the Oakland area. So, again, the Oakland police had information about Wayne Cullinan and did nothing about it and released him as a time bomb so that he could return later and be useful to the police. And he was useful to the police. Very important to these negotiations is always the psychological CIA police expert on political terrorism. In this case, it's Dr. Hatcher. He's from the University of California, as I said before, Langley Porter. And he gave out a profile about a man, he didn't know him at all, Wayne Cullinan, that he said he wanted to die for a cause. He was on television Sunday, and Wayne would be dead on Monday morning. He said it became clear he wanted to die for a cause. He had extraordinary demands, $5 million to distribute to the poor. His plan was self-destructive. If you're able to die for a cause, then your death will stand for something. It's that same script used about Lee Harvey Oswald. He didn't like the left, the USSR. He didn't like the right or the middle of the United States, but he wanted a place in history. He wanted to be known, and it makes it look as if these are political kamikaze deaths, where they're actually police operations used for politicians for election campaigns and to give professions and notoriety to people like Dr. Jolly West and Dr. Hatcher. Hatcher said he had delusions of organization of power. He had compatriots and comrades, and he would act as if he were working in unison but overruled by the group. Those fantasies that Donald DeFries had of being a great leader like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were part of the fantasies the Vacaville gave him. You see, it's one thing to have fantasies that you want organization and power, that you have comrades and compatriots. It's another thing to be able to take a Mercedes-Benz and credit cards and expense money and all kinds of cash that you need and pull up to a building and walk through the building and take some people to escort you to an office, and then they depart and don't turn you in. It's the tactical support that Donald DeFries has when he goes to Soledad and he walks out of there and goes back to his compatriots in Berkeley, and the police don't even look for him there when they've been corresponding and visiting him in prison. It's one thing to have the vision of being the leader, the comrade, to die in glory. It's another thing to have the tactical support to make these fantasies appear as the reason for all of this, these things that come down. This man took in that building a 30 caliber carbine. He took a 410 shotgun, even a toy pistol, hand grenades, flares with batteries that were taped to his body. And Dr. Hatcher comes in with a total news media coverage, out here at least, on his suicidal wishes to be famous, to go famous, and be killed by the police. And sure enough, the prophecy is fulfilled, because within 24 hours, less than 24 hours, in 12 hours, he is dead in the police department and killed by the police. There's another important thing that takes place here, and that's why I read these documents to you each week that are coming out because of the Freedom of Information Act, about the government spray, whether it's on oats or whether it's to make us lose our resistance, the tests in Utah, to cause delirium, or whether the sprays in San Francisco to round people up, to lose their reflexes so that they can be rounded up. This particular operation requires drugging so that the persons can be killed before they speak. At the time of the SLA, when I wrote my article, the SLA is the CIA. I mentioned that the neighbor next door was asleep in the bathtub, drowsy, and that these people, three of them, tried to leave the building and were shot down at close range, and three were asleep. With all this firing, had died underneath and were asleep. At the time of the FBI shooting of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, where Charles Bates was, the FBI agent O'Neill, who was a best friend of Fred Hampton's, gave him a substance that obviously Fred Hampton didn't taste, but which made him drowsy. So when the police broke in and gunned down the door and gunned him to the head in bed and made sure he was dead, he didn't even have time to wake up. Well, in this case, in the SLA case, they sent out for their food. The FBI man wasn't the agent inside, like in Chicago, but they brought no food with them for the siege. They had no provisions, and everything was brought in from the outside, the food and drink. And this gentleman asked for food, and they brought from McDonald's some hamburgers and soft drinks, which he drank and also the hostage drank. And they were very sleepy, and they were fed these foods. And then when the police broke in Saturday afternoon, he was described in the newspaper as yellow and jaundiced and weird-colored. The San Francisco Examiner said that he was bent over and limp. His face was yellowish and distorted. He was almost jaundiced, and he just looked almost comatose. When the police came in, both the hostage and the great terrorist, Wayne Cullinane, were asleep. He was lying down in fetal position, sound asleep, and his hostage had a blanket, and she was sound asleep. And when the police came in, he was almost comatose and discolored. And I believe that they made him that way by whatever they brought down in a tasteless substance identical to what Fred Hampton got or the SLA got, so that the victory would be the police's. No police, nobody would be hurt. And the only victim, of course, were the taxpayers in San Francisco and Mr. Cullinane, who then was killed the next morning, just 24 hours or 12 hours later, as I say. These tasteless substances are given. They were given to Hugo Pinnell at his trial that I attended in Salinas. He was charged with killing a guard at Soledad, and he was sitting there, and you would believe it was an important trial, because killing a guard and being a defendant with the San Quentin Six, being up at San Quentin when George Jackson was killed and the guards were killed, you'd think he would be awake, but Hugo would fall over the table drowsy and fall asleep at the table. He passed out at the table. And Robert Hyde told me that they were putting tranquilizers in food up at Vacaville. So I know in the SLA case, and it's been proven in the Chicago case and also in San Francisco, that these people get sick and get drowsy, and then the police come in and solve the case, and everybody's grateful that it didn't get worse, and the chemical company has done it one more time. Now, before I run out on this tape, I have to talk about who gains from all this craziness, and it is total craziness. There's an article in the paper yesterday by Sanford Gottlieb, the head article, "Americans Forget There Are No Winners in a Nuclear War, the Insanity of Nuclear Weapons and What We're Doing." But if you heard Mr. Brzezinski several days ago, I believe it was on Wednesday, on television saying over in NATO and Germany that he wouldn't hesitate to use atomic weapons and go to war. Of course, Mr. Brzezinski and Mr. Kissinger are not Americans, and the mistake Americans forget is not that there are no winners in a nuclear war. They forget there's no winners in arming against the Soviet Union and using Germans and Poles and Nazis to lead our government. Now, in San Francisco and the streets of this country, we'll get violence because there are no winners in this kind of craziness. What are the motives here in San Francisco? First of all, the elections, as I said, are coming up in 4 weeks. The police are in bad shape because of the terrible prosecution of Dan White, who was a member of the San Francisco Police Department, the unsolved Zodiac killings, the beating up of the gay community, the riots the night of the Dan White sentencing, and they don't even go back to less than a year ago to the Jonestown links to all of the San Francisco politicians who are running for re-election, Mayor Feinstein and Freitas, who wants to be the district attorney again. Freitas and Feinstein are in the news, so this way they worked, they caught the man. Feinstein was up, as I say, 17 hours with the negotiators. Her name was in the news, and it makes them look like they are working hard. And then the articles come out that the police are the saviors. Articles come out praising the police department. They came out smelling like a rose. Another thing is that by having the death of Mr. Killane, he was found hung in his cell Monday morning. He was supposed to have an every 30-minute check. He was in the Dan White cell. The psychiatrist had said he was suicidal. And instead of watching him after 3 in the morning, nobody came by till 6:30 in the morning, and he was hanging. And they said they heard noises in the cell in the area and thought it was normal, even though there was a 30-minute check. But what it brought out was we need more police. We need more police in the jails. We don't have enough money with Proposition 13. There's violence on the bus in San Francisco. Juveniles, they don't ask for one child psychiatrist. They don't ask to go to one home to see what children are doing or why they're doing it. They say, get out the cat of nine tails. They call the radio stations and start public flogging. Get police on every bus. Get police on the rapid transit and more police in the jail. So this increases the budget and the necessity for more police. Another payoff is that the new graduates of terrorism get their degrees. This woman and this man who carried this entire thing were tested in this school. One was a new graduate. The other man had only done one job of terrorism in 5 years. And in Los Angeles, when the SWAT team came out, they were ready. The military were ready to come on the streets of America at prime time and kill in your dinner hour and test your stomach for cremating 6 people without a trial. And it worked. Nobody said anything. Nobody cared. They accepted it like they would if it were Vietnam. That was the inauguration in America on public television of the SWAT team, the military teams. And in San Francisco, the terrorism team paid off because they figured 5 years of training and it worked, and now they have this command post, these psychiatrists, and the men and women with all kinds of operations getting ready in case there are uprisings in this country. Another point is that Sheriff Hengista, who was considered too liberal by many in San Francisco, was coaxed out of going and went to Cleveland and then to New York and appointed in his place as a Sheriff Brown. I'm very close with a black sheriff that worked up there with Hengista and left there after Hengista left. He went on to Harvard to take future studies, but he told me he couldn't stay in the sheriff's department because of the rampant racism in San Francisco. They're literally like the Klan or Nazis, and they can't stand the blacks there in charge of the sheriff's department. And Sheriff Brown was appointed to this job after Hengista left, and the elections come up in 4 weeks. And the newspapers are filled with all kinds of articles on the laxness of Sheriff Brown, that 2 men were killed in the jail this last week and 2 more the month before, and there's been 4 escapes. One of the men who escaped was represented by Mr. Schmidt, the attorney for Dan White. He escaped, and then another gentleman escaped out of the bathroom when the sheriff was watching him. The sheriffs are letting them escape and then closing down on the law enforcement and saying, in the elections in 4 weeks from now, we'll get rid of Sheriff Brown. So the military teams are tested, the psychiatrists are tested, the command force are tested, they get rid of the black mayor, they can laud the old team for political purposes and use it for political campaigning. Whatever we get out here, you get next, so be ready. This is Mae Brussel and Carmel, and I'll see you next week. It's very important because this is a microcosm. This is a crazy state. What we get, you'll get next, so watch out. It's coming your way. This is Mae Brussel and Carmel. You take care, and I'll be with you next week.